It is Monday, September 9th, 2013, and this is episode 34 of the Defensive Security Podcast. By the way, I'm sorry this is a day late. You know, sometimes you can't control when your son's going to jump over a cart and almost break his arm. So,
Likely story.
Yeah, right. Anyhow, as usual, the thoughts and opinions Mr. Kellett and I share on this podcast represent just our own views and not those of our employer. So with that, I'll hand it over to Andy to say hi.
Good evening or good morning or good afternoon or, you know, whatever time it is you're listening. Thanks for having me back, Jerry. And hopefully that whole domestic violence charge is quickly dismissed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, as they always say, as long as you're not convicted.
That's right. And I'm sorry for missing last week. I do want to thank Jerry for bailing me out, though, you know. But I'm back now.
So. I don't think he listened to it because he might not be so kind.
No, actually, that's sad. I did not. I've been busy. I have things to do.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, you may not thank me if you listen to it.
Oh, my. All right. Anyway, let's get rolling.
So one thing I wanted to start off right out of the gate saying is you had an excellent idea. And this is something we're going to integrate from now on. And actually, I've personally gotten some feedback in the past how the thing a lot of people like about this particular podcast is the slant on defensive strategy. And so your idea was, well, why don't you go ahead and describe it?
Sure. I was thinking we would take something like an attack broad category or attack technique or some sort of issue that companies are facing, pick one a week and just talk about, you know, strategies that work and ideas and ways that you can help fight those particular attacks. And, you know, we call it something like the attack of the week, and might be inspired by a news story, might be inspired by, you know, just common things that everybody's facing, and just try to take a, you know, kind of a no-nonsense vendor neutral approach to it, really with the idea being, and this is something that I'm a big believer in, is that, you know, preparation is key. So when you're fighting the problem or when you're in the crisis, is not the time to figure out what you're going to do about it. So that's the plan.
Absolutely. And I think it gives us an opportunity to maybe unlink from the recent news and really maybe go into a little more depth about different things and be a little more measured. So, but we are going to continue talking about stories. So let's go ahead and get started. The first topic we wanted to talk about, and there's a lot of news about this, obviously. It's probably the predominant IT story that there has ever been and there may ever be again. And this goes back to the NSA and Mr. Snowden and the information that he's leaked. And one thing that I want to couch this discussion with is, you know, let's put aside the politics for a second and let's think about what was done relative to the exfiltration of data. And, you know, I had a very frustrating discussion with someone on LinkedIn. There was some, a couple weeks ago, there was a story about the NSA implementing a pretty dramatic reduction in the number of system administrators to cut down on potential leaks. And you know, nobody can get past, or at least a lot of people can't get past the politics of it. And that's kind of frustrating for me from a defender position, because, you know, this is a great opportunity to, you know, think about a very real problem that most businesses face. And so,
yeah.
Sorry. So, you know, one thing I'll just kind of set it up, right? Originally, it was identified that he stole about 20,000 documents. It's now believed to be closer to 60,000, possibly even higher than that. based on some things that were found with Glenn Greenwald's husband when he was detained in Heathrow. We know that in the NSA, they apparently used a Citrix-like environment where you, as an administrator, you would remotely connect into a thin client or with a thin client to a Citrix-like backend. And we also know that he had elevated access. And apparently, a lot of the controls that apply to the general, you know, user population didn't apply to him. And so, you know, the rank and file NSA operator might not be able to copy things to a thumb drive, but because he was a sysadmin, he didn't have that restriction. So, you know, to me, this is something that I've personally been wrestling with for a little while, is IT administrators are, you know, a significant source of risk in an organization. And partly that's a function of how large your organization is and how many people you have on that staff.
All the reason we should outsource to India. That definitely solves that problem.
or apparently to, you know, Dell or whoever Snowden worked for, I forget.
Booz Allen.
Booz Allen, there you go, thank you.
Not that this is their fault. We're not blaming Booz Allen.
Knew it had alcohol involved in it. But I didn't want to say Boone's Farm, I'm sorry. Dang. I'm really tired.
See, this is why we don't do this late on Mondays.
I know. So continuing my thought process there is, you know, you really have to think about how, I guess, in the context of your environment and the things you have in your environment, you really need to take a look at administrators and how you properly segment things, right? How do you implement separation of duties so that you have some kind of an interlock that doesn't allow this kind of thing to happen, or at least detects when it does? You know, there's some story in this NBC.com story, which is linked to in the show notes, about how it's believed that he took advantage of his time zone difference being in Hawaii. You know, I think it's, 5 hours different from the Washington, D.C. office. You know, there wasn't apparently a lot of oversight about what he was doing. And so they believe that probably had some amount of benefit to him because, you know, people weren't watching over his shoulder, so to speak.
Well, and this goes back to something we were speculating about a while ago, which is that, and it's kind of talked about in the story too, is that the NSA, like most large ungainly enterprises, doesn't have a very high-tech information security system going on. And I think any company of sufficient size to warrant it is probably better served realizing that, hey, your admins have a lot of power, and if they go bad, you know, they're kind of the ultimate insider, and not to play the boogeyman or, you know, throw some fun here, but, you know, this is very akin to something that the intelligence agencies figured out a while ago, which is that their primary agents are the main source the bad guys want to turn. So they're very good at counter intel and watching their own agents. So, you know, with that thought process in mind, it's, you know, very much a good idea to have a separated from IT security operational department that is just there to audit and oversight. You know, they probably don't have the need to have administrative levels and this sort of stuff, but they need to be able to at least have the technology in place or something in place. Not that anything can't be subverted, but make it a little tougher. There was nothing to audit what this guy did. This is why I think they're having so much trouble understanding exactly what he did. Now, of course, we're speculating a little bit, right? We don't know anything for 100% certain, but if we take this article at face value, this shows that the auditors or the sysadmins had complete absolute control and trust. And that's absolutely a silly thing to do.
Yeah, and I can tell you there aren't a lot of people that can relate to the challenge, I don't think, right? Because a lot of this is a function of the size of the organization. And the larger your organization is, the more of a problem it is. And so if you have an IT shop that has 5 people or 10 people, and you know, you can reach out and touch every one of them, you know, it's not, at least in my mind, in my experience, as big of a problem as it is if you have, you know, let's say 10,000 or 20,000 administrators. I mean, that's a very large number of people. And whenever you have that number of people, you know, you've got, just like any segment of society, you've got rapists, murderers, bank robbers, you know, and everything else in between.
Yeah, I agree. It's at a certain size, it's almost completely unmanageable. You know, and in that sense, you know, maybe you go to a pure instrumentation sense, right? Make sure you have auditing controls on everything so that, you know, you may not catch it, but at least you can reconstruct it, or at least you can figure something out to a certain level. I'm sure the admins can turn off the auditing controls, but ideally that's alarmed, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know,
really quickly.
And an alarmed in such a way that they can't go in and, you know, neuter that alarm.
Right. You know, or it could be a massive, you know, pain to build this. But if you're protecting these kind of secrets, let's keep that in mind, right? This is all relevant to what you're protecting.
Exactly.
You know, they clearly could have done a better job. Now, like anything, it's probably really, really underfunded. You know, they've got an immense amount of outsourcing contractors here. It makes it very difficult. Well, hey, that is one of the risks you accept when you start outsourcing.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's just what it comes down to. But, you know, I think the takeaway for me in this story, for the point of the show, is have you stopped and thought about what's in your intellectual property and if your admins could take all of that without anybody knowing?
Right.
And is that a concern? If it is a concern, maybe it's time to start to think about doing something about that.
Exactly. Exactly. I think you said it very well. All right. Let's move on to our next story, which is also sticking with that theme. And this is an article from, Information World or InfoWorld. And the title of it is How to Secure Your Company Against NSA-Inspired Hacking. And, you know, I don't like to dog on the works of other people, but I'm not a real big fan of this article. And for a couple of reasons, and I do encourage everybody to read it because, you know, hey, it's always better to understand more context, right? But you know, one of the things that bothers me is, and it's not just this article, there's a lot of what I would characterize as overreaction, right? I completely understand and grasp the concern around this, you know, the spying and the scandals, especially with some of the more recent disclosures about apparently the NSA has some additional programs, which, by the way, if you've been paying attention, really shouldn't be a surprise to you that, you know, that they have these things going on. But as a company, right now, maybe not as an individual, right? Let's separate that for a second. As a company, it's my view that you really shouldn't be focused on hiding your activities from the NSA. And likewise, I'm not convinced that a lot of the techniques that are being described here are really directly portable to non-Intel agency kinds of things. You know, so for instance, some of the recommendations here are to use open source encryption versus closed source because, you know, who knows what the NSA may have coerced or paid a commercial company to do. But, you know, my retort is that, and by the way, you'll probably not find a bigger open source supporter than me. But the reality is, who's to say that the NSA didn't influence open source authors? You know, this is, it's kind of silly and frustrating.
So I 100% agree on the last comment. It is frustrating, and I could go off on a many hour rant, which I will spare you, on this entire topic. But first of all, I think it is a huge tactical mistake to ever weaken a security system for your own use. You never know when somebody else could potentially exploit that at a fundamental level. But I don't think that's primarily what the NSA has been doing. I think they've done a lot to very straightforward, in a very quiet way, go to a lot of different manufacturers of code and say, listen, don't you want to be a patriot? We need to know what's going on. And to get their master keys and to get all sorts of information. Now, we've always said you're going to have a hell of a time defending yourself against a nation state level funded operation, right? And that's what we're seeing right here. However, it doesn't mean that I like it, and it doesn't mean that I think it's a good thing. I think it's weakened a lot of trust, and it's shaken a lot of people's assumptions about what is protected and what is secure and what isn't. I found it a couple things interesting. One, there's a lot of speculation that the NSA has intentionally weakened various algorithms. And they were caught doing that once back in 06, and everybody abandoned it quickly and, didn't really go very well. There's probably a very small amount of people who can actually truly audit encryption code, which makes it difficult to know.
Absolutely.
And that's a companion, comment to the open source thing. Great, go use open source. Can you audit it?
Exactly.
Are you qualified to audit it?
Exactly.
Who's auditing it? Who do you trust to audit that, right? How do you know? Great, you compiled it. What did you just compile? And I'm not trying to rip on open source. I like open source, but there's a fundamental assumption that open source is safer because you're hoping somebody else has audited it for you, unless you have the skill set, and very few people do.
Especially in the area of crypto. I think that's right. The one thing that people get a little lost in is this stuff is extraordinarily complex. And if you have a sufficiently sophisticated adversary, they could put something in there and you could have PhD people looking at it and not recognize what they're seeing.
So, at the end of the day, we don't really have a choice, right? We still have to use encryption. We still have to keep the 90 percentile out. It's still best practices. It's still the right thing to do. It's still what we need to do to keep most of the people out. And, I think everybody just became a lot less naive. I think everybody just lost some innocence here. The next thing I would say on this is, on top of the open source thing, is what if the stuff's in hardware? What if there is an NSA master key sort of thing, for making it easy to talk about, in hardware encryption chips? How are you going to know? How do you know what the hell's in a Core i7 chip? Really don't know.
How many billion circuits are in there?
So, I'm not saying this is right. I'm not saying I support it. I certainly do not support it. But at the end of the day, I don't think this changes the majority of what we do as defenders, because our main adversary is not the NSA. You could argue that, but it's not, And I do not in any way subscribe to the, if you're not doing anything illegal, you have nothing to hide thing. I think that's wrong. I think that privacy is fundamental. But I do think at the end of the day, encryption is still a very valuable technique to keep the 90 percentile out, and we shouldn't knee-jerk and throw the baby out with the bathwater. But we probably need to start having a little more of a thought process around who can get into this. And the last thing I'll say, because is anybody can break encryption. It really comes down to how much horsepower and computing you have. But the best ways to attack crypto is not to go after the encryption. It's to go after the methodologies and the implementation of that crypto, going after the key capture, going after, weaknesses in the way it's implemented. There's so many ways that you can mess up implementation of good crypto. That's a lot easier to exploit. So, it comes back to good tradecraft more than anything.
Absolutely. And if you pay attention to some of what's been described about how the NSA is going about this, I think there's some subtext in there that you have to read between the lines on. And I think they've found a lot of novel ways to gather enough what I'll loosely call metadata that enables them to intelligently attack encrypted streams. And you know, there's a couple of other things I had observed about this, you know, and number one is, I think as an organization, as a business, it's fruitless to plan your security strategy around evading the NSA.
Yeah.
Or any intelligence agency. They will be able to outspend you no matter what. They're not the droid you're looking for, as they say.
I mean, unless you're another state-level sponsored intelligence agency,
exactly.
In which case, you know, Jerry and I are always available for consultation at a premium rate.
That's right. That's right. And then the next observation is that, you know, from my view, and one of the points of this article was, you know, again, not necessarily that the NSA is your adversary, the thing that you're trying to protect against, but, you know, kind of like we saw with Stuxnet, where some of the virus writers started to adopt some of those techniques. You know, might we start seeing some of the, the bad guys adopting some of these techniques, and or at the very least becoming aware that some of these quote back doors might be in existence and then go after them. But you know, my thing is, or my thinking is that, you know, the NSA in general isn't really focused on particular targets. They're really in the business of very broad surveillance, very broad-based surveillance, and capturing as much as possible. And you don't often see that kind of technique manifested in crime, in criminal, right? Now,
right.
Maybe some of the the more economically motivated nation-state actors, but maybe
I would say there's a lot of broad spectrum botnets and data exfiltration, you know, malware that is pretty widespread and that just dumps stuff and people go and look and see what random stuff they picked up. But, you know, yes. It depends on what sort of malware you're talking about.
But and that dovetails very well into my third point, and my third observation is that, you know, unlike what we've seen with the NSA, almost every kind of criminal enterprise, including those nation state actors, you know, which go by the name of China in most circles, who are looking to steal data, they go after the endpoints, right? They're putting malware on your system. They're phishing you. They're doing watering hole attacks. You know, they're bugging your house. They're breaking and entering and, you know, stealing your computers. That's how they're doing it. And so from that perspective, things like encryption and two-factor and all of these basic block and tackling things are still very effective.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one, for the breaking and entering, that's why I have a guard cat on duty at all times.
It's a big cat.
I pay him a catnip, and it works out well. But yeah, if somebody's got your end unit, right, your endpoint, and they're watching all your keyboard entries, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what kind of encryption they're using because they've got your key, right?
Exactly.
I mean, so that's the kind of thing of like there are so many other ways to attack encryption. And, you know, back in the day when PGP first came on the market, Phil Zimmerman had all these, you know, what seemed like esoteric way of doing things. You know, he was kind of right, keeping your private key on a USB stick. And, well, back then it was a floppy. But, you know, at the end of the day, if you really care, that's what you kind of have to do. You know, and you could go off, I could go off on a long discussion about a rant, soapbox rant, about encryption. And encryption is not a panacea because there's so many vectors to get to the data. Encryption only works when you're coming from a vector that isn't supported, right? So you have to keep in mind, how are the bad guys going to get the data? I don't care if you're encrypted. If I'm coming through, you know, if you have full disk encryption and I log on your laptop, I don't care that it's encrypted.
Exactly.
Right? It'll
the whole ecosystem.
Yeah, it'll happily decrypt itself for me, right? So anyway, I think it's a sexy story. It's an important story. It's a fascinating story. But at the end of the day, it's it doesn't really change in my mind at this point a lot about what we as enterprises need to do. And yeah, I could be wrong, you know, it's, but that's my opinion. And yeah, that's what I'm here to give.
And, you know, I would sum it up by saying, as an organization, we really need to think about what threat we're trying to protect against, because, you know, we don't have infinite amounts of resources, and we have to be economic about what we protect against.
Sure. You know, when we go back to foreign nation states like China stealing IP, I think that's a huge one. I think that's happening all the time.
Yes.
And, you know, that's the kind of thing where you got to start thinking about this stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, the fortunate part, I guess, is from all we know, they're not using incredibly sophisticated methods.
They don't need to.
Exactly. They don't need to.
You know, they're going to use what works.
Right.
So
anyhow, well, I guess one other piece of advice that we have learned from this is, if you are carrying around a hard drive with top secret material in your bag, which you're not supposed to have, don't keep the encryption key printed out in the same bag. It's words to live by. I'm pretty sure Abe Lincoln or somebody says something about that.
I'm just going to go back to using Rot 13 on everything. Just call it a day.
You know, I have heard if you do two iterations of Rot 13, it's even better.
Excellent idea. Yes. I'll give that a shot.
All right.
Even
Sorry.
Moving go on.
All right. Moving on. This next article is from Dark Reading. And this is about getting the most out of a red team exercise. And I think most everybody is very familiar with red teams. But the interesting thing I thought about this article was put a new spin on it for me. And that's using red team exercises as a justification for future investments. And so, you know, we all use red teams to, you know, identify our weaknesses. We use them to exercise our incident responders and our monitoring people and that sort of thing. But, you know, it is a little novel, at least in my opinion, to use them as a justification for, hey, you know, we just did this and here's the result. You know, we can continue to live with this risk, or we can do something about it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, you know, this is one that's been kind of a hot button for me for a long time, is people will go and get an external pen test once a year and, you know, fix the problems brought up in the pen test. And like, hey, we're great. Yay. It's a lot more than that. You know, one of the things they talk about in this article as well is, typically when you're doing some sort of pen test or red teaming, there's all these artificial constraints around them. And how is that a fair test, right? The bad guys aren't going to use any artificial constraints. And frankly, I'd rather my internal red team find a problem than the bad guys find the problem, even if it's, you know, potentially disruptive.
Yeah.
You know, to plan around that as best I can. You know, the other thing I would say is that it should be an ongoing thing. No system is static. You know, every time a new application gets rolled out or a new, you know, a patch is put out there or new admins have been added or removed, things are changing all the time. So you can't think of your environment as static and say, well, you know, we just red teamed that a year ago. We're good for, you know, another month or two. You never know. It has to be, in my mind, an ongoing process. But having folks who their job is just to, you know, coordinated in a coordinated fashion, you know, on your side, helping you test this stuff is, I think, very valuable. And you know, for rightly or wrongly, it gets executives' attention. And, you know, so-and-so was able to break in. The other thing I would say as a caveat to this is that sometimes people use red teaming and pen testing and they'll find a way to get whatever they're getting to and they resolve that one way. It doesn't mean it was the only way. There could be a lot of other things that red team didn't need to go find because they got to whatever their goal is. So you know, be careful how you set these constraints and goals around this red teaming, because if you say go get that file on that server and they find a way to go get it, they found one way to go get it. Didn't mean they found all the ways.
Right.
The bad guy still might be able to find another way.
So. Yeah, just about every pen test team, at least the competent ones that I've ever interfaced with, you know, they say that, and you know, it's probably some ego too, but you know, they claim that they've never not gotten in,
right.
And it's pretty believable, but I think you make a really good point that, you know, if you put too much limitation on the. On this kind of exercise, you're not going to get the full value. You know, if you have a team that stops after they get in, you know, that's not all that useful to you, because how many other ways can you be compromised and you're just completely ignorant of? And it's even worse because now you have a red team in your back pocket, red team exercise in your back pocket that said, hey, we found a way in and now we've closed that hole. And you run around saying, hey, go us. We fixed the problem.
Yeah, false sense of security. Yeah, but a good red team, a good pen tester, you know, they're going to go beyond just one thing. And you know, like you said, your miles may vary. You know, choose wisely who you choose to work with if you go external. But, you know, the other thing I'll say about this is that it's interesting, too, is that I've seen over and over and over again very highly qualified, skilled people who work for an organization telling their leadership, we need to do X, Y, and Z. And until an external organization comes in and does something and then says the same thing, you guys need to do X, Y, and Z, that leadership doesn't listen for whatever reason.
Yeah.
It's this weird psychology. And so that's another use for these red teams is, you know, you get external validation of your internal position on something.
Yeah, it's the value of consultants. I think there must be a named law about that somewhere. I'm sure, you know, we've long lamented about that particular problem, but you know, one thing I've also noticed about this, and you touched on it a little bit, is I see two things organizations commonly do with these exercises. And number one is they put boundaries around it that are completely artificial. You know, we don't want it done in production. We don't want it done at this time of the month. We don't want it done here. But, you know, the reality is attackers don't give a damn about any of that. They're you know, they don't have restrictions. And
right.
And so if you don't test it, you know, somebody else is going to test it and it's not going to be on your time and they're not going to be friendly to you. The way you're going to get the report is in the news.
Yeah.
Or a call from the FBI or something like that. And the other thing I see is a lot of organizations will say, you know what? We have a lot of problems and we know we have a lot of problems. So what's the point? And that frustrates me a lot.
Yeah, they sort of are in analysis paralysis, or, you know, the problem is too big to fix, so let's just ignore it and just do what we can with what we have.
Right.
And, hey, that's your company's choice. But we're here to talk about, you know, what will help.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, organizations have to make value judgments based
right.
on what they're, you know, what they're willing to tolerate. And, you know, if your organization is not, you know, does not value that highly and is okay with being compromised, you know, that is okay. If you're, you know, if you make cakes, you know, that might be all right. But, you know, if you're a high tech company with intellectual property, that's probably not okay.
Right. No, but that is what it really comes down to, is there is no right answer. There is an answer for your organization's risk tolerance and budget and, you know, reality of your situation on the ground.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I think we beat that one to death. So we're going to now move into the defensive strategy section of the podcast. And so for tonight, we have selected a topic for your listening enjoyment. And that is DDoS.
Ooh, you know, we need bumper music like news organizations have for this section.
I'll see what I can come up with.
Something like, you know.
You know what? I think I just got it.
Oh, joy. All right. DDoS.
DDoS. You know, I think if you're listening to this podcast, you know what it is. So, you know, I'll kick it off and I'll give you my thoughts. You know, number one is when you're thinking about DDoS, figure out if you care.
Right.
You know, I've seen so many people get worked up about DDoS.
Jerry, do you care?
Well, depends, right? I mean, I work for a very big business.
I mean, but do you personally care, Jerry?
Only if it affects me.
All right.
How about that?
Fair enough. Carry on.
You know, and I think there's a lot of solutions out there to protect against DDoS, but you know, there are some fundamental things that hopefully everybody understands. And for the most part, DDoS attacks are bandwidth starvation kinds of attacks. And so pretty much nothing you can do on your premise is going to be really effective at mitigating them. And so there's lots of companies that will sell you a box with lots of really awesome lights. But at the end of the day, they're probably not going to do what you want to the level that you think. And so you're probably needing to take a look at, you know, given what you're trying to protect, what's the right solution for you? And so, you know, there's different solutions, right? You've got ISPs. ISPs provide DDoS mitigation services, and they tend to be pretty freaking expensive. And, you know, if you self-host, that might be a good idea. Another option that a lot of people are increasingly going to are the CDNs, you know, the content delivery networks, the Cloudflares and the Akamai's. And I personally, I've seen a lot of companies somewhat resistant because you have to let go, right? You have to let go of your website. Somebody else has your website now. They're running the show. And so, you know, there's some introspection you have to do if you're going to take that. But it also tends to be, in my experience, one of the more effective solutions if you're trying to mitigate DDoS against a website.
Sure.
And then, you know, there's possibly some, you know, a third option, which I call roll your own, right? So, you know, you do your own distributed thing. And I suspect that in today's economy, that's becoming a lot less attractive for a lot of businesses to pay for, given, you know, the availability of commercial services. So what do you think?
No, I think you hit on a lot of good points I was going to say. I would take it back up a level and say, it depends on the type of resource exhaustion attack somebody's throwing at you. If somebody's playing who's got a bigger pipe, you absolutely are going to lose, and I agree with you. But, you know, to back it way up, you know, what I like to start with is, okay, let's think about what happens if you're going to get DDoS. Let's say somebody saturates your pipe. First of all, they're probably going to go after, they're probably going to target, most likely, your internet-facing infrastructure, stuff running, your website, your DNS, your email, something like that, right? So let's think about that. If it's sitting on your main pipe, your only pipe, and they DDoS it, how does that affect your operations? All right, if that's unacceptable to you, what if you split that up to a different pipe, right? So that your you know, internal operations, you know, your secretaries need to go to the web or whatever it is they need to do, can still operate while you're under DDoS, right? So you can still make your widgets and do what you need to do while under DDoS attack. You know, secondarily to that, I agree with you, moving it out to you know, something like a CDN is definitely a great idea. If you want to roll your own, you know, it depends on what somebody's attacking. If somebody's going after an IP address, you know, you can move your sites around with very quick TTLs on your DNS for those domains. But more than anything, I think it comes down to preparation, right? Have a plan ahead of time. Think through what you're going to do when that DDoS hits, right? What are your actions? Don't try to come up with that when you're under attack. You're not thinking as well as you could be when you're, you know, you're just sitting around the conference room table role-playing out the situation. and train for it. You know, it's, I was reading an article the other day, and, you know, going off topic slightly, I'm thinking about putting together a talk on what aviation teaches about risk management. And one of the things they say is, you know, when's the last time you thought about, hey, you're flying along and there's smoke in the cockpit, right? When that happens is not the time to think about it. And so very similar with DDoS, right? When that happens is not the time to figure out what your plan is. Right. So
it's too late.
Right. It is too late. So, you know, whether it's re-architecting your environment to spread out those most likely targeted assets to places that can actually sustain, or at least getting it away from, you know, the rest of your organization. I used to work for a company where I ran operations, and we had some very smart folks who used to do internal DDoSes, not necessarily intentionally, but we ended up having to re-architect the network so that when they internally DDoSed, they just hurt themselves, right? So the rest of the operation could continue. So end of the day, I'm not very, you know, up on those boxes that you could put on your customer prem to stop a DDoS. I just think if somebody's filling your pipe, it's too late. You got to work with your ISP. You got to work with the CDN. You got to work with them ahead of time. And you really got to figure out a good plan, whether that's, you know, you can just sustain it and it doesn't matter. And you've got backup plans and you've got a T1, sorry, old vernacular, you can bring online, or a cable modem.
Cable modem. There you go.
Cable modem, DSL line, and you keep operating or something, right? Have a backup plan. Have a contingency plan. Think of it as like DR. But the time to think about it is not when you're under attack. And but at the end of the day, there are no magic bullets with a good DDoS. It is inherently using the structure of TCP/IP against itself. And there is no magic solution.
Yeah, I think it comes back to just general risk management. And you said it very well. You know, how can you separate components of your operation? So, you know, as an example, you know, you don't need, look, DDoSes happen against websites, right? Offices, you know, networked offices don't get DDoSed, right? That just doesn't happen. Websites get DDoSed. I suppose there's probably the 1 in 1,000 chance that I could be wrong, right? But for the most part, it happens against websites. So, you know, obviously, if you rely on your website for selling things or marketing or whatever, you know, that's a bad thing. One thing I would tell you to consider is, you know, a lot of companies will count downtime in dollars on their website. But the reality is, if what a lot of people don't accommodate in those thought processes, that people will come back. And so if, let's say, Amazon is down for an hour, you know, they might be able to say, oh, we lost $25 million. But the reality is that $23 million extra dollars were bought, you know, the next hour when it was back up, and their real loss was $2 million, which is still a big number. You know, so you think about things in those terms. But as you also said, you know, do what it takes to keep your core operations available. And so if that's, as you said, making widgets and your people need to get on the internet to, you know, converse with business partners or whatever, you know, move that off where it's not going to get DDoSed. It's pretty simple. Bandwidth is pretty cheap nowadays. You know, you don't, unless you're a huge enterprise, you know, a cable modem, a 50 meg cable modem is pretty damn cheap these days. You know, so, you know, that's my thought process. I do have a couple of really tactical things that I have noticed, because, you know, I'm in a pretty unique position. So two things I've seen. Number one is, don't let your equipment get to its maximum utilization.
Oh, yeah. Great point.
I have seen several DDoS attacks be very successful, and these DDoS attacks were quite lame, but they were very successful, because, you know, the firewall or the router or the switch was running at near capacity. Even though they had ample bandwidth to handle lots more traffic, it fell over, the network fell over, because, you know, it couldn't handle the incremental load.
And, you know, to be fair to the DDoS vendors who make customer prem equipment, that's exactly what they're designed for,
yes.
Right? They're designed to sit in front of that gear and filter out that DDoS traffic that is more of a resource exhaustion, not necessarily a bandwidth exhaustion. The bandwidth is a resource. And prevent it from hitting those devices. But 100% agree with you. You have to build that infrastructure for the spikes. And so couldn't agree more. Great point.
And you know, the other thing I've seen is, you know, we're all familiar with the reflected DNS attacks, right? It's pretty simple stuff. But I have seen this, and the one thing I would say is work with your ISP and do not allow port 53 traffic inbound from the internet to your web server or anything associated with your web server. It's just bad practice because, you know, you're just asking for it, right? Find another way to get DNS queries in and out of your network, right? But don't let them, you know, inbound from the internet. Go to your ISP and ask them to put in some ingress filtering. Just don't allow it. That's going to probably, in my experience, that's going to solve half your problems.
Did you just blame the victim when you said you're asking for it?
Yes.
All right. Just checking.
Sorry. Sure. Sorry to all those victims out there. But the point remains, talk to your ISP. Think about what traffic you don't need coming into your network.
Now, to be clear, you know, the ISPs are not that sophisticated. Most of the time, they're basically setting up some ACLs for you, right? And most of the time, when you're under active DDoS, they're just trying to do some filters on their core routers for you. So, you know, keep that in mind. But ahead of time, sure, you could. That's a great idea to block. You know, yeah. The one other thing that reminded me, and I'm sorry to steal your thunder for just a second here, is while we're on the topic of DDoS, we are seeing now some bad guys using DDoS as a distraction. So one thing to keep in mind, if you're being DDoSed, don't concentrate all of your defensive forces on that one issue. Keep some folks available to watch other things.
Yeah, and in fact, you ought to heighten your, you know, awareness of what other things are going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not just keep some spare capacity, but actually go and see if there's any evidence that somebody is in fact doing that.
And it might be worthwhile to invest in some MiFi cards or mobile hotspots for your IT staff to have alternate means of getting to the internet and checking on things that are maybe in the cloud that they're trying to keep you from getting to. You don't know.
There yeah, absolutely. It's great point. Absolutely great point. And you know, while we're talking about black and stuff, I know this is out of left field, right? But I don't know. Have you seen the latest news about the new malware? I can't remember the name of it that uses Tor as CNC.
Yeah. They, you know, it was funny because everybody thought that the doubling of the Tor users was because of Snowden.
I thought that was funny.
No. Well, what is it now?
Occam's razor, people.
Yeah. Well, somebody was predicting. I think it might have been. Who was it? I don't want to say it because I'll be wrong. Somebody was predicting that something like 57% of all Tor exit nodes were owned by the government anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, take that with a grain of salt, right? It's late. I've had a couple of beers. That could be a completely wrong stat. But you don't, right? There's another thing. How can you trust Tor, right? You don't know. It's completely anonymized. So you don't know who it is, which right. is not saying you shouldn't use Tor, but it's like always check your assumptions. So, yeah, well, that it's funny though.
I'm going to say, and the reason I brought this up is, you know, going back to implementing filtering, a lot of IPS engines and some firewalls too will allow you to block Tor traffic. And I would advise you right now, for whatever that's worth, I would advise you to block Tor traffic out of your company's network. And I would go farther and say, when you see it, go figure out what the heck's going on.
Fascist.
I know. It's just me. You're going to catch stuff like this. I guarantee you, almost every time, if you do this, you're going to find something going on. You're going to find malware. You're going to find an employee doing something that they shouldn't be doing, whatever, right? There just isn't a good reason. And if there is a good reason, set up a little, you know, side environment for them to do that kind of crap. But, you know, I just think it's one of those easy opportunities as defenders that we can throw out a net and catch a lot of crap.
Sure.
So anyway, I think that was the DDoS talk, and hopefully you all thought that was worthwhile, and thank you, Mr. Callett, for the idea. That was great.
Well, I hope so. I hope people find it valuable, and would love to hear feedback. Send us email, send us notes on Twitter. Don't send us any white powder in the mail. We don't appreciate that.
Yes, thank you.
You know, if people have ideas and you know, thoughts of what we should talk about, an attack of the week, you know, we'd be happy to entertain those.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've both been doing this for a long time, and we've seen a lot of things and done a lot of different things. And, you know, I think we've got a lot of different and creative ideas to bring. We come from slightly different perspectives. So if you do have additional ideas, you know, send me an email. We would, you know, we'll love it. But, you know, I think we've got a list of topics if nobody else sends anything in. So anyhow, that is the show for this week. Again, I apologize for it being late. In closing, I would like to make two call outs, and I would like to say hi to the 754th Electronic Systems Group in the Air Force, who I have seen very aggressively listening to the podcast.
Hi guys, love your work.
Absolutely. Thank you for your service. Thank you for all you do. Keep on keeping on. And I would also like to say hi to the Department of Justice, who is very diligently visiting the website every day for a very long time. I'm honored. And hey, you know, I respect your work too. So.
And I swear I thought she was 18.
He had to go there. All right. Normal closing. If you have any thoughts, ideas, questions, criticisms, you know, you don't like my voice still, you know, you wish, you know, Andy had a better voice, whatever. Send me an email, info@defensivesecurity.org, or on Twitter @DefensiveSec. You can find me on Twitter @MaliciousLink. You can find Mr. Callett on Twitter as @Lurg. And with that, I bid you adieu. Have a great week. Say goodnight, Mr. Callett.
Take care, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Bye.